This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with professor and historian Alfred McCoy about his new book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change.
It takes a giant in the world of historians to write a book like this. His interview is really extraordinary.
We then speak with Professor Henry Giroux, who speaks about the growing fascism in America.
But he doesn't think we're past the point of no return.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Today we speak with University of Wisconsin history professor Alfred McCoy about his new book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. The United States of America has been governing the globe now for 80 years, since World War II. This is about to end. By 2030, China will have the world's largest economy and hold more in riches than the U.S., which is deeply in debt. The America we knew will change drastically as a world power, just as the previous world powers, the British, and before them the Dutch, and before them the Spanish and the Portuguese, all saw their empires end. Climate change will upend the world. It already has started. The effects of climate change on the population of the world, especially China, will be catastrophic. The great coastal city of Shanghai, where 18 million people reside, will sink. Millions of the 400 million Chinese people in the North China Plain will be forced to evacuate. What can we learn from the demise of the great world powers in the past? Where is the United States headed, and how soon? What might be done to ameliorate this dire future? Only a prodigious historian would undertake to answer these questions. Our guest today is such an historian. Alfred W. McCoy holds the Fred Harvey Harrington Chair of History at the University of Wisconsin. He has written 20 books, including The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, for which he became well known, and recently In the Shadows of the American Century. We welcome Professor Al McCoy back to Law and Disorder to talk with us about the important new book, To Govern the Globe. Al McCoy, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael and Marjorie. Pleased to be here.
Al, we owe your magnificent book to a fall you took on the ice on one of those terrible Wisconsin winter days. I've got a picture in my head of you sitting on a chair at a table with your leg extended in a cast, working 18 hours a day, every day for a year on that manuscript. Was that what it was like?
Well, that's pretty accurate. First of all, it wasn't a cast because it wasn't a bone break. I just shredded three tendons in the knee. So it was a mechanical brace, and it was not 12 months, but 5 months. But for 5 months, I was confined to a chair. I couldn't really walk. I couldn't drive. I couldn't get on an airplane. Fortunately, I was on sabbatical. So I just really, and also because of the leg brace, I couldn't really sleep more than about 5 hours a night. So basically, I just sat in that chair for 5 months with great stacks of books and articles and the internet. And by the time the brace came off in summer, I had the first draft of a book. And then it took me another year of cleaning it up and also realizing what I was trying to say.
That's great, Al. The United States has been a major world power for the last 80 years since World War II. It's a world power in the economic, military, and political spheres. Can you please talk about this?
Sure. At the end of World War II, in the midst of this cataclysm that left over 70 million people dead and cities destroyed on several continents, the United States emerged as the most powerful empire that had ever existed, the most powerful empire in human history. And we used that power to do two things. One, to establish our hegemony and dominates the globe beyond the Soviet bloc and then the Sino-Soviet bloc. And second, what we did was we used that power in concert with allies and in dialogue with civil society groups, and that dialogue with civil society groups was tremendously important, to build a world order that was in many ways the culmination of the struggle for human rights over the past five centuries. And that world order, which was enshrined in the UN and a whole succession of like international organizations, was founded on two basic principles. One, all human beings had universal human rights, and all human communities had the right to live in a sovereign state, and that sovereign state had inviolable sovereignty. And like all world orders in the past, this world order had a duality between power and principle, and that power was exercised by the world's most enormously powerful military, and also by a very new method of projecting power, the CIA and covert projection of power. And so there was a yawning contradiction in that system. One, the United States had built this liberal international order where every nation had inviolable sovereignty, and yet the United States was a great global hegemon, and in the asymmetric nature of the power, the United States necessarily had to violate that sovereignty. So how could the United States break its own rules? Well, the only way to do it was to do it covertly. And so in 1947, we established the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, and it was originally supposed to be an intelligence organization, but it very quickly transformed into a covert apparatus for intervening overseas, for intervening when we couldn't be seen to intervene, in other words, to do it covertly. And it was the CIA that gained enormous power because it mediated that fundamental contradiction in the U.S. world order.
We're speaking with historian Al McCoy about his new book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. Al, in the past 700 years, there have been other world powers, the Iberian power of the Spanish and the Portuguese, then the Dutch, then the British. What lessons can we learn from their rise and decline?
Really, from the 16th century right to the present, there has been, as you just said, Michael, this amazingly diverse array of dominant world powers, all the way from rather small, lightly populated Portugal to the United States, which is a major continental power. But through this succession, there has been one absolute constant. The rise of every nation to global power has been coincident with its dominance over the vast Eurasian landmass. And the decline of that same power has coincided with its loss of control over that same Eurasian landmass. And so it is with the United States. You know, at the end of World War II, when we had that enormous power that we've just been talking about, the United States became, as a British historian named John Darwin has argued, the first power in 1,000 years to control both axial ends of Eurasia. And how do we do this? Well, at the start of the Cold War in the late 1940s, the United States formed the NATO alliance, and we built massive bases like Ramstein Air Base in Germany, and that gave us a secure anchor at the western axial end of Eurasia. And then on October 1st, 1949, when Mao Zedong stood up in Beijing at Tiananmen Square and announced the formation of the People's Republic of China, and then within months forged an alliance with the Soviet Union, creating the Sino-Soviet bloc, an alliance between Stalin and Mao, suddenly the United States realized that containing communism wasn't just a matter of Europe, it was global. And so the United States very quickly in 1951 and then 1953 signed four mutual security pacts with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia, giving us this Pacific littoral, a line of massive military bases stretching from Japan through the Philippines all the way down to Australia. We didn't have actual bases in Australia, but the Australians had their own. And this Pacific littoral, which the Chinese call the First Island Chain, became the fulcrum for U.S. geopolitical power, the fulcrum for the defense of one continent, North America, and the projection of power to dominate another continent, Eurasia. And then the United States ringed those two axial points, those two anchors of bases at the west and east of Eurasia, with successive chains of steel. First of all, mutual defense pacts stretching from NATO in Europe to CETO in Southeast Asia and ANZUS with Australia and New Zealand. next two powerful fleets, the Sixth Fleet in the Mediterranean Atlantic, the Seventh Fleet in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific, and then we added later on the Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf, and then hundreds of military bases, thousands of bombers and missiles, and we ringed Eurasia with these powerful chains of steel, and we contained the Sino-Soviet bloc behind that Iron Curtain, and that was the key to our success in the Cold War. We could simply sit back and wait for our rivals to make mistakes or not, as the case turned out. And, you know, that the breaking of those chains are what the world is witnessing today in Ukraine and in the South China Sea.
Al, as the Spaniards slaughtered the native populations in the Caribbean and Mexico, there was internal opposition. I'm thinking specifically of the Dominican priest Bartolome de las Casas, and also the Quaker and Methodist opposition to the British slave trade. Can you discuss that, please?
Sure. First of all, I said, you know, at the beginning, every world order has a duality between power, manifest in empire and principle, which is articulated by civil society activists, most often people that have profound principles, and historically these are religious principles. Bartolomé de las Casas was not only a critic of Spanish imperial conquest, he participated in the conquest of Cuba, and he, as he describes in his short history, his famous short history, his most translated and read work. He was in Cuba, and he describes, for example, he said, the natives laid before us a feast, and we sat down and to enjoy that feast, and then we slaughtered 300 of them. And he describes this succession of massacres that, in sum, destroyed the indigenous population of the Caribbean, the Tainos and the Arawak, who only survive today in the genes of the peoples of the Caribbean. They're basically been extinguished. And de las Casas had a, you know, reading the Bible, had a blinding moment of spiritual insight and devoted the rest of his life to not only exposing these great crimes, but trying to stop them. And he started, at the very end of his life, he came to a realization. First of all, he wanted the Spanish to stop enslaving and slaughtering the Amerindians. So for a while, he actually suggested the African slave trade might be an alternative. Then he realized that this was a great crime. And in his last writings, he recognized that he had made a terrible mistake, because what he realized is that everybody, pagan and Christian alike, we're all humans, and we all have human rights. And that realization of fundamental humanity came right at the start of this process. And that unleashed a kind of dialogue that other Dominicans, like Francisco de Vitoria, who was a lecturer in law, at a Spanish university, he gave very famous lectures that were recorded and published, and that inspired Hugo Grotius, the great Dutch legal scholar, who's often considered the architect of international law and the modern international system. And that dialogue extended to the United Kingdom, where, again, the so-called dissenting churches, the Quakers, the Methodists, and evangelical Anglicans, decided that in the late 18th century, when Britain's empire as major activity was the Middle Passage. Over half the slaves carried across the Atlantic in the latter decades of the 18th century, which is the peak of the slave trade, were carried on British ships. And the profits from the sale of the slaves, the work on the British West Indies plantations, all of that produced enormous wealth for Great Britain. So at this peak of British imperial power, these dissenting churches launched this massive campaign, an island nation of 10 million people in Britain. They got a petition with 1 million signatures, and in 1807, the British Parliament announced, they passed legislation abolishing the slave trade. And at the settlement of the Napoleonic Wars in the Congress of Vienna, Article 15 in the treaty, which most people don't read, not aware of, is this ringing denunciation of the slave trade, calling on all the nations of the world to abolish it. And as soon as the Napoleonic Wars were over, the British Navy, the Royal Navy, the most powerful military force on the planet, spent the next 70 and 80 years with its prime military mission, the abolition of the slave trade. They lost 15,000 sailors in that fight, and spent about 2% of their gross domestic product, and they succeeded in abolishing the slave trade. Of course, there's always that other side of the duality. That's principle, created by those civil society groups, enshrined in law and enforced by naval power. But then there was the other realpolitik side of British imperial power, and they conquered colonies and introduced forced labor, unpaid forced labor, in the European colonies in the Imperial Age from the 1880s to the 1930s. Ordinary people, adult males, all adult males had to work between 16 and 20 days a year of free labor building imperial infrastructure. So it was a halfway station on the path to human rights. And then at San Francisco in 1945, again, as the Americans were, at the end of World War II, Europe was in ruins, the British Empire was in decline, although they hadn't realized it yet. It was all over for imperialism. And at this moment, when the United States was setting up this current international order, the first conference to form the UN was near Washington, D.C. at Dumbarton Oaks, and it was kind of a closed-door imperial club, and they agreed that the Security Council would be all-powerful, and as Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, they would have an assembly so that the little countries could get together once a year and blow off steam. Okay, so it was supposed to be a closed imperial club. And then they took that to San Francisco, where all kinds of delegations turned up from American religious groups, Jewish groups, the NAACP, labor unions. There was Latin American delegates had a kind of pre-UN conference, and they came with their principles. And the United Nations, the more open, equitable organization that we have today, was transformed by that civil society input. So civil society is of paramount importance in articulating and propagating these principles that temper the ruthlessness of empire.
We're speaking with Al McCoy, who's recently written To Govern the Globe, World Orders, and Catastrophic Change. Al, you write that the United States will be eclipsed by China by the year 2030. How so?
Sure. First of all, it's not just me that's been saying this. The U.S. National Intelligence Council, which is the supreme analytic body of the U.S. intelligence community, every 4 years writes a predictive report. And back in 2012, I think it was, they issued their report, and they said that by 2030, if not before, China's economy will be larger than the U.S. economy. And he said that they were witnessing an historic shift of power. In the 18th century, power moved from Asia to Europe, and now it's moving from west to east. And in terms of global power, economic strength, they said we can predict that Asia will be more powerful than the United States by 2030. And the international accounting firm, PricewaterhouseCoopers, known as PwC, predicted that by 2030, in terms of real purchasing power, China's economy will be 60% larger than the U.S. economy. Now, since over the long term, the United States and China spend roughly 2% and about 3% of their gross domestic product on defense and defense procurements. If China's economy is 60% larger, they're going to be spending more, and they have a very lively and growing defense military establishment. And they are no longer a near-peer competitor. They're a peer competitor. And they're now moving, I think, beyond parity. Just take late last year, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff said that he had a near-Sputnik moment because China had successfully tested a hypersonic missile. Now, that's a missile that flies at least 4,000 miles an hour. The United States has been trying to develop hypersonic missiles, and every test we've had has basically burned up because they're flying so fast. So it's an enormously technologically challenged issue. China's done it. And that means they have a missile that can penetrate any possible continental U.S. air defenses. In other words, they can launch a nuclear strike on any American city, and we can't stop them. And more importantly, that means they can knock any American aircraft carrier out of the water about anywhere in the Pacific, particularly close to China itself, where they have more conventional missiles called carrier killer missiles that are already capable of taking out an American aircraft carrier. So when your military establishment knows that if it comes to war, we lose, that tempers your foreign policy. That means you give way to the dominant superior power. And that is just now starting to happen.
Al, how does the accelerating climate change catastrophe figure into all of this? For example, the huge coastal city of Shanghai going underwater, or people on the plains of China dying of heat stroke, and the massive population migrations that would ensue.
Sure. First of all, prediction is enormously difficult. My own discipline, history, when we try and track the past and the future, we usually get it wrong, and not only wrong, but almost laughably so. Economics and political science don't like even medium-term predictions. They don't like to go much beyond the next election or maybe the next recession. But environmental science is different. The whole logic of environmental science is developing tools of observation, like ice cores, pulling ice cores out of Antarctica and Greenland and analyzing them, and then making projections all the way to the end of the century, grounded in computer modeling, natural science research, bringing all these diverse tools together into this very powerful science of environmental prediction. So what I did in my book was very simple. I simply took those environmental trajectories, I read the science, which is published in journals like Nature Communications, peer-reviewed, very solid, and I read the UN reports, and I simply overlaid on top of that likely changes in the political order that might be caused by this change. Okay, so if let's assume that the United States is a waning imperial power and China is on the ascent, and somewhere around 2030, China begins to build an alternative world order, okay? So how long is their world order going to last? My sense is if you look at the environmental science, they've only got about 2 or 3 decades on top, which is not long for an empire. Not long for a world order. Why? Well, first of all, by 2050, and the environmental science is very clear on this, sea levels will be rising, and Shanghai is arguably the most vulnerable city in the world to sea level rise, except perhaps maybe Miami. But it's very similar. It's not up a river like London. It's not protected by something like the Verrazano Narrows in New York, where you can put up a sea gate. You know, it's a coastal city, and it was dredged from swamp and sea starting in the 15th century. And the environmental science is very clear. By 2050, most of Shanghai is underwater. And that means a city of 18 million people and the economic engine for much of the Chinese economy is going to basically be underwater. The next thing is it's not just global warming, it's global heating. And a professor at MIT has published an article in Nature Communications, and he said that by 2070, there will be hundreds of extreme weather events in the North China Plain, which will become, he says, one of the least habitable places on the planet. Now, the North China Plain is currently home to 400 million people. It's the agricultural, in many ways, the demographic heartland of China. 400 million people is 30% of China's total population. And those, not only will there be hundreds of extreme weather events, but there are going to be at least 5 events in which there will be 35 degrees centigrade wet bulb temperature. Now, what does all that mean? That means that in the balance of heat and humidity, at that point, 35 degrees, the human body can't sweat. And so all of us, you, me, and Michael, sitting here, we'd be dead in 6 hours at rest under 35-degree wet bulb temperature. And there'll be 5 protracted incidents of that lethal, fatal climate. Well, as China recoils from the damage to its coastal cities and the successive heat waves hitting its agricultural heartland, diminished crops, dislocations of population, it's going to have to pull back from the world and begin to address serious domestic issues. And worldwide, there are now 200 million people will be uprooted by climate change by 2050. There are now other projections from other groups that say it's as high as 1.2 billion people will be climate change refugees by 2050. The existing world order is absolutely incapable of handling that kind of movement. You know, think back. Between 2016 and 2018, we had Middle Easterners coming into the Greek islands into Europe, the sub-Saharan Africans crossing the Sahel, the Sahara Desert, and crossing the Mediterranean. We had Central Americans and some Mexicans, but mainly Central Americans, gathering at the U.S. border and trying to cross. And this was a shock to the international order that produced this rise of ultra-nationalist right-wing groups across the world. It led to Britain leaving the European Union. When you add up those Middle Eastern, African, and Central American refugees, that's only 2 million people in total, were a shock to the current world order. And so by 2050, when you're talking about 200 million or 1.2 billion climate change refugees, the current international system is simply incapable of handling it, and it will crumble and collapse under that kind of pressure. So around 2050, we'll be without a global hegemon, we'll be without a world order, we'll be facing a world disorder, and we need to think about alternatives.
How do you see the Russian invasion of Ukraine following the expansion of the U.S.-controlled military alliance NATO up to the border of Russia and the U.S.-sponsored 2014 coup in the Ukraine as being a fight to control what you talk about, controlling the Eurasian landmass?
Sure. You recall earlier I said that the geopolitical basis for U.S. global power has been since the late 1940s, for the better part of 75 years, has rested upon the military dominance and the over Eurasia, initially containing the Sino-Soviet bloc behind the Iron Curtain, but even in the aftermath of Cold War, maintaining that apparatus of control to dominate this. Because, as I said, every world power, every global hegemon since the 16th century has dominated Eurasia. Eurasia is home to 70% of the world's population and productivity. In order to be a world power, you have to dominate Eurasia. So what we're looking at is something we haven't seen since the Stalin-Mao alliance, which lasted actually very briefly from 1950 to 1953, and very quickly those two powers split. So it's really been about 60 years that we haven't seen an alliance between the two major powers on the Eurasian landmass. Putin and Xi Jinping are allied, and they're allied in a very similar strategy of trying to mount pressure to snap those chains of steel that the United States laid around the Eurasian landmass. And this means Eurasia has been a kind of ring of fire, and if you connect the dots, the geopolitical dots around the continent, what you see is the pressure in Ukraine, the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan, which China made possible by ringing Afghanistan with a geopolitical chains that basically isolated the United States. There are military maneuvers in the Himalayas with the Indian Army mobilizing troops to check China. There's the Quad, the alliance between Japan, Australia, the United States, and India conducting the Malabar live-firing naval exercise in the Bay of Bengal. There's China swarming its aircraft in the Taiwan Strait. It's a joint Russian-Chinese fleet that late last year just steamed around all of Japan, formerly U.S. waters. And then there are maneuvers in the Arctic, joint maneuvers by China and Russia. And so basically what's happened is that China and Russia together are mounting this campaign of tension, this campaign of pressure to slowly snap those chains of steel, push the United States off the Eurasian landmass, drive wedges in the NATO alliance, weaken the bilateral ties between those four powers, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Australia, and the United States, and thus take control of the Eurasian landmass and emerge as the dominant powers in the world. And that's what we're witnessing. It's an epical change. So that economic decline of the relative decline of the United States, China's ascent economically, China's ascent militarily, it also has a geopolitical dimension, and we will see a succession of like events going on all around this ring of fire, around this the 6,000 miles of the Eurasian landmass, for till the end of the decade, by which time U.S. global power will be over, and then we'll see a new form of dominance in Eurasia and the rise of a new global power.
Well, thank you, Al McCoy. We've run out of our allotted time. This is a good point to end, and we recommend heartily that our listeners read your new book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. It's available from Haymarket Books. Thank you very much, Al, for your time today and for your good work over the many years. We wish you the best.
Thank you. Thank you, guys, very much, everybody, for having me on the show, okay?
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
An American form of fascism is unfolding in our country. What exactly it is and what we can do to fight it is the question of the day. We see a massive political effort to legitimize and normalize white minority rule. Things are happening rapidly. Just a year ago, our Capitol was attacked pursuant to a plan to reverse the results of a presidential election. Soon, the Supreme Court will likely overrule the almost 50-year-old precedent set in the Roe v. Wade case on the question of a woman's right to control her own body. Voting rights have been and will continue to be extremely restricted, particularly in communities of color. Irrational and magical thinking has been legitimized. Over 900,000 people have unnecessarily died of COVID. There has developed in our country a culture of cruelty manifested by Trump, but initiated in CIA torture and detention camps for Muslim men and boys in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. It didn't start after 9/11 with the wars against Afghanistan and Iraq. It goes back further than that. America has been prosecuting wars abroad during our entire lifetimes. The provocations against Russia regarding NATO military encroachment on its borders are the latest chapter in almost continual and seemingly endless wars. A lesson of history since Greek and Roman times is that if you can't have imperialism abroad and democracy at home, well, you certainly can't do them both at the same time. We speak today with Professor Henry Giroux, who currently holds the McMaster University Chair for a scholarship in the public interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department. He has written many books, most recently The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, and also the book American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Henry Giroux, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely, our pleasure. Now, you write that there's no single version of fascism. Well, how would you characterize, then, the developing fascism in America and distinguish it, perhaps, from fascism as it developed in Germany or Italy or Spain?
No, I don't think that fascism is simply of one piece, but I do think there are certain principles that get updated and take on a particular form endemic to the country in which they're being produced, and I think there are a series of warning signs, particularly in the United States and in some cases across the globe. And one is the ultra-nationalism that we see everywhere now. The other is the emergence of white supremacy as a legitimate discourse. The other is that we see what I would call the claim that America is in decline. You see the elevation of instinct over emotion. You see the attempt to suppress dissent. You see the attempt at contempt for weakness, the hypermasculinity, the culture of fear. I think the anti-intellectualism. I think what I call the politics of disposability and the claims of racial purity that we see. Also the emphasis on censorship, the rewriting of history in a way that seems to suggest that white nationalism is the only way that people can occupy, the only discourse available for people to occupy the public sphere. I think all of those issues basically represent a rebranded form of fascism that emerges through a particular lens of American culture that has now given us a warning sign about, you know, how they fundamentally echo the past.
Henry, you've written that, quote, the lines between democracy and authoritarianism are collapsing, close quote. How can you demonstrate this?
Well, I'll tell you, one way to look at it is to look at the recent report
from the Economist Intelligence Unit, which talks about the rise of the suppression of dissent in the United States, the collapse between the truth and misinformation, the cult of the strong man, the lies, the attack on civic culture, and of course, the increasing, and more than anything, the increasing use of violence as a political form to basically threaten, institute a culture of fear, and to appropriate and engage in the struggle for political power. I mean, the January 6th revolt, it seems, or insurrection, it seems to me, is a classic example of what I would call a counter-revolution. I mean, it's a counter-revolution going on in the United States. You know, it's an attempt to undo democracy, undo the Constitution, undo the rule of law in multiple ways. I mean, when you get a former president of the United States promising, when you get a president of the United States during his term, you know, offering pardons to criminals, I mean, claiming that treating the Justice Department as if it's its own personal lawyer, you know, trying to negotiate ways in which he could overturn the election, and then getting a Republican Party that absolutely endorses all of that stuff, and believes in the big lie, and goes so far as to claim that the insurrection itself was nothing more than an expression of legitimate political discourse. I think it's pretty clear that democracy is under siege, not to mention what he's done with the Supreme Court, which really seems to be now captured by a bunch of conservative thugs who have no understanding of what it means to take seriously the promise and the ideals of democracy, particularly around both voting rights and the reproductive assault on women's bodies. So I think, yeah, we can say that those institutions, those principles, those ideas that are meaningful in a democracy are beginning to collapse. Civic culture is collapsing in the United States. You know, civic culture is basically something supported by what I call a democratic formative culture, in which questions of community, justice, fairness, compassion, understanding, respect for the welfare state, respect for unions, respect for counter-opinions are really operative. And I think increasingly what we see is a war on all of those things. And they're not hard to discern. And I think in that sense, yes, democracy is on the decline in the United States, just as the Economist report pointed out a few weeks ago. It actually downplayed the United States from what it called a full democracy to a flawed democracy.
Yes, as have other organizations in the world which rate and qualify how high or how low on the democracy scale nations are. Now, Henry, also, I wonder, we hear this word, you know, the term neoliberalism thrown around rather freely in this country. What is neoliberalism, and what role do you think it's been playing in preparing the ground for the seeds?
Neoliberalism is the most pernicious philosophy that has come along since the divine right of kings. And it basically emerged in the 1970s under Carter, but when Ronald Reagan married Margaret Thatcher, it became basically, and with the fall, of course, of the Berlin Wall, it became a full-fledged ideology that seemed to suggest that the only thing that really matters is the market, and that the market is not just an economy that concentrates wealth and power in the hands of few people, is a template for not only basically regulating the market, but regulating all of social life. And so it seems to me that what neoliberalism has done is that a number of things. It seems to suggest that the only thing that matters is unchecked individualism, harsh competition. It replaces the notion of the public good and all forms of solidarity with a kind of Benthian war of all against all. It puts a premium on competitive attitudes, degrades collaboration. It claims that markets should regulate themselves. It's absolutely wedded to a form of economic Darwinism in which privatization, commodification, deregulation are the mantras of how the market should work. And it privatizes everything. And I think that what we have seen under neoliberalism are two things. We've seen the increasing concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a financial elite. We've seen the emergence of massive inequality that is really a killing machine. We've also seen basically a pedagogy, an educational thrust that seems to suggest something very deadly, that all the problems that we face are individual problems, and that private troubles are basically just that. So any problems that we face, we have to face alone. That has produced a massive form of alienation, depoliticization, and it does something tragic to a democracy. It operates off the assumption that people can no longer translate private issues into larger social considerations, so they have no understanding of systemic problems and how they work.
Henry, you see our culture as shifting. Lenin once remarked on this phenomena. He said something to the effect that nothing happens for decades, then all of a sudden, decades seem to happen in a few days. Would you share that observation?
Yeah, I guess when Ronald Reagan made the declaration that government is really the problem and not the cure, something shifted. And what shifted was a discourse at the highest levels of power that's now said that capitalism was unchecked and that it could do anything it wanted. And all of a sudden, we saw an enormous assault on public goods, on unions, on schools. We saw a counter-revolution in the making, in which people were increasingly responding to the decades of democratization and protests that went on in the 1960s and the 1970s. And I think that we saw democracy in free fall, and it has never recovered, and it got worse. We saw the move from basically an investment in public goods to the rise of a financial elite in which money completely dictated politics. And so we saw a major collapse here around rights. While personal rights suffered and political rights, of course, suffered, voter suppression laws, as obvious, among other things, but social rights suffered, meaning that we now had a redefinition of freedom and justice and equality that were really their opposites. I mean, freedom meant the freedom to do anything you want. Justice meant don't address the questions of injustice. Social responsibility meant, you know, by the neoliberal mantra that economic activity should be divorced from social cost. And what that meant is you no longer had to think about ethics anymore. So in that sense, there was a real shift in the culture, yes. And there was also an increasing shift in higher education and public education, which has always been a laboratory for democracy. I mean, you know and I know what happened after 1980. All of a sudden, the universities became corporatized. And all of a sudden, 70% of the faculty was no longer tenured. There was a massive assault on academic freedom. Many of them lost their jobs, lost their benefits, and it no longer became a center of, in my estimation, of struggle. The great public intellectuals today are not academics, they're journalists. And I think that, you know, we lost that critical culture that was so central to the 60s and the 80s, along with the institutions that informed it.
Now, I wonder, Henry, too, would you agree that we've been witnessing in recent times a massively increasing political effort to, well, legitimize and normalize white majority rule?
I think that's a fabulous question. I really do. And I can't tell you how much how important that is. Yes, but I'm going to just qualify that a bit. It's not white minority rule. It's white supremacist rule.
Mm-hmm.
Let's be honest here. You know, this is really about keeping people of color, brown people, black people, out of the democratic process. And it's done in ways that uses the language of white supremacy, white nationalism, and outright and overt racism. We've seen it with Trump. We see it with the Republican Party. We see it with policies that are... Can you imagine? You and I now live in... the United States is now a country that says that school teachers, if they talk about slavery, or if they talk about injustices in the past, they could be fired, fined, or who knows, punished by viewing such behavior as criminal behavior. Does that remind you of something? Do you have to be a rocket scientist to not recognize that we saw the same thing in the 1930s in Germany? You know, when all of a sudden certain forms of knowledge were considered debased and corrupted and they burned books in the name of racial purity? I mean, this is white supremacy unadulterated. There's no other way to talk about that. It's not simply white minority rule. It's white minority rule in the interest of racial cleansing. First you burn books, then you ban intellectuals, then you burn bodies.
Henry, please talk about the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, and then the attack on women's reproductive rights, the attack on voting rights, and the attack on racial justice.
They're all connected. And I think that what they're connected by, not the fact that they're expressions of a Republican majority sort of hating all of those things. They're connected because they're part of a counter-revolution. They're part of a counter-revolution that recognizes that wherever justice and freedom emerge, in terms of a collective effort to deepen and expand the possibilities of democracy, it has to be shut down. And that's exactly what they're doing. This is a counter-revolution that believes in violence, not just violence in the way that we saw given the attack on the Capitol, which is an attempt to both legitimate Trump and the cult of leadership in that form of particular form of fascism. But it's also an attack on education. It's also an attack on women's bodies. It's also an attack on justice. It's an attack on all those areas in which people may have some control over their political, social, and political rights. And so I think in that sense, we're not just dealing with a minor insurrection. Oh, I'm sorry. We're not just dealing with an insurrection that's almost unthinkable in terms of what happened in an attempt to legitimate it. What we're dealing with is a full throttle, full-fledged attack on democracy. That's what we're dealing with. I mean, you know and I know. In the 70s, you know, you had the Powell Memo, you had the Trilateral Commission talking about the excess of democracy. That was a warning. They wanted to fight that battle in the realm of ideas, and they did. But with, of course, the Heritage Foundation and all kinds of conservative institutions emerging, Fox News, the social media. But this is different. This attack on democracy operates under the threat of force, under the threat of outright censorship, and under the threat of the language of white supremacy. To put it bluntly, you know, having studied critical theory all my life, you know, I think it was Horkheimer who once said, you want to study fascism, then you better look at capitalism quite carefully.
Well, following up on that, Henry, I want you to talk a bit about that in this context. I mean, you've got guys like Charles Koch and others, you know, funding the Republican Party, funding God knows how many other right-wing projects in the country. Talk to us a bit about the relationship between big business and the growth of fascism.
I think there are, thank you again for a great question. I think there are a couple of things. I think that with the financial crisis of 2009, something became obvious. And what became obvious was that neoliberalism failed. It failed on its promises. It was going to lift the boat. Everybody, you know, it was going to redistribute wealth. Everybody was going to be happy. Everybody would have jobs. You know, security would be somehow taken care of. We wouldn't have to worry about unions. You know, the private sector could operate more efficiently than the public sector. Well, this was all nonsense. And so it couldn't defend itself any longer in terms of the promises that it had put forth. It turned to something else. It turned to fascism, a fascist politics in which it now blamed blacks. It now blamed immigrants. It now blamed Muslims. It now blamed the people who believed in the common good. And in doing that, it seems to me that it opened up for corporations and the financial elite, particularly those on the right. This doesn't include all corporations, and it doesn't include all of the corporate elite, but the hard right corporate elite, the Koch brothers, you know, Peter Thiel, you know, a whole range of these, Elon Musk. These are corporate thugs, you know, and they really believe that profit above all absolutely has to be sustained through a logic that says that the government should in no way interfere with what they do. This is Milton Friedman on steroids. That's what this is. But it's not Milton Friedman simply on steroids. It's the Milton Friedman who supported Pinochet. It's the Milton Friedman who believed that dictatorships provide more opportunities for corporations than democracies do. And that's what we're seeing now.
For our listeners who just tuned in, we're speaking with Professor Henry Giroux. Henry, do you think that we're past the point of no return? And if not, what good things do you see developing on our side?
I don't think we're ever past the point of no return. There was resistance even in the camps. I mean, I think there are a lot of hopeful signs. I mean, particularly among young people. I mean, I think that young people, teachers, are really mobilizing in a way that suggests that they no longer want to be written out of the script of democracy. And they're also realizing that in many ways they now inhabit a culture of such overt violence without apology that they can't fight this alone. And so, you know, we see young people, of course, protesting against violence, school violence. We see teachers walking out of schools because their roles have been diminished. You know, there's a women's rights movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, along with other black movements and brown movements. These are very powerful movements, and they offer enormous hope. The only thing is they suffer from two problems that have to be overcome. And one is they really need to stop being fractionalized and unite in a mass party that's able to be systemically organized to put pressure in ways that bring power to bear to stop this fascist politics that we're engulfed in. Secondly, they need to take education seriously. I mean, one of the things that we've learned from the convoy movement in Canada, increasingly now coming to the United States, is that social messaging matters. The media matters. It's a massive educational machine that can function in the interest of domination or the interest of liberation. I mean, it can change consciousness and it can destroy it. And I think in many ways, you know, those two issues have to come together. We need to bring people together in a mass movement, a mass social movement, uniting these different factions without denying the importance of the forms of oppression that they point to. And secondly, we need a massive educational movement that takes popular education seriously and really knows how to use the media to be able to speak to people in a language they understand and in which they can recognize themselves and in which they can rethink the conditions under which they find themselves.
I wonder too, Henry, certainly it would seem the Republican Party or great portions of it have endorsed and embraced the violence of January 6th. Violence is, as I think you've talked about and written about, endemic to fascism, is it not? Talk to us a bit about what you, I think, have called many signposts that give rise to this kind of violence and how it becomes normalized.
Well, I think it becomes normalized when it becomes repeated endlessly and treated as entertainment or just treated as news without any serious analysis of what causes it and what the underlying logics and forces are that produce it. I mean, violence is the DNA of American culture. It's everywhere. We're an increasingly militarized society, and I think that what, if you want to point to one central element that's caused it, it's very simple in my mind. And that is, as the social state declines, and we can't address social problems by getting at their roots and dealing with them in ways that address them, then we criminalize those problems. And when we start to criminalize those problems, criminalize poverty, homelessness, the kinds of problems that young people face in schools, you have a massive expansion of what I call the punishing state. This is called creeping punishment. And that creeping punishment is endemic to fascism. And it's endemic to supporting politics of terror and domestic terrorism, in which violence becomes the organizing principle by which we both organize society and use it to address the problems that we address. It's about the exhaustion of neoliberalism. It has no answers anymore. And so we have to resort to violence and increase the punishing state, the carceral state, in order to deal with this stuff. That's why you have, I mean, think about it. Last year, the police killed more people than they have in the last 10 years. I mean, over 1,000 people were killed by the police. I mean, you have a system out of control in terms of not having the social supports, not having a society that provides social provisions, not having a society that addresses massive, massive inequality. I mean, inequality is a killer. It's a form of necropolitics, and it's run rampant. It's unchecked right now in American society.
Do you believe the Democratic Party can be trusted to do a good job in defending us? Sheldon Wolin called the Democratic Party the inauthentic opposition. And right now they've been supine. They refuse to mobilize the American people. What are your thoughts about that?
No, I think we have two parties. One party is basically the strong party of Wall Street, and the other party is the weak party of Wall Street. I mean, they're both wedded to Wall Street. I mean, they're centrist liberals who don't believe in the distribution of wealth, who don't believe that capitalism and democracy are not the same, who don't believe that in some fundamental way the system doesn't work. They want to put band-aids on the system. And then when they get attacked, like all liberals, you know, the definition of liberalism that I always love of liberals is that when a fight breaks out, they leave the room. You know, that was Obama, right? I mean, he left the room.
Yeah.
And he couldn't do more to please the right. They're more afraid of the right than they are the left. And it seems to me that translates into something horrendous, because a centrist today in the United States, in Europe, would be on the far right. They wouldn't be called centrist; they'd be called the far right. I mean, Biden. What does he do? I mean, beyond his infrastructure bill, I mean, does he talk about free education? Does he talk about universal health care? Does he talk about redistributing wealth? He doesn't talk about any of these things. I mean, and he's going to be defeated in 2024, no question in my mind. He'll be defeated. The Democrats are too weak. They're not justified, and they have people in the party who basically are Republicans, who are Republicans in drag.
Henry, as we speak, there are I don't know how many trucks basically over the last couple of weeks brought government more or less to a standstill in Canada. And now they're lined up at in my old hometown, Detroit, at the Ambassador Bridge, stopping traffic now from going over there. They're talking about coming down to the Super Bowl, having a whole cross-country parade of trucks. So far, nobody's figured out how to stop them or what to do about it. How should we read this? How should we see this?
I think this is a counter-revolutionary movement that's taken the notion of freedom right out of the neoliberal handbook and so abused it that basically it's now attracted it's attracted white supremacists, neo-Nazis, you know, people who basically have no concern for the common good, anti-vaxxers, a lot of conspiracy theorist types. I think it needs to be named for what it is. They have a great social messaging system. They have the instruments to basically wage a massive strike, and they're doing it in the name of the abuse of freedom. I mean, this is a full-fledged, unadulterated attack on the common good. That's what it is. This isn't about freedom. This is about the death of democracy. And I think that what we see here is an inability of the mainstream and liberal press to really unpack this for what it is. This is not just about, you know, doing away with mass vaccinations. This is not just about repudiating public health officials. This is an attack on on government responsibility. This is an attack on social justice, and this is an attack on the public good. That's what it is. And it's got to be named that way. I'm not sure how this is going to be resolved without engaging in massive violence occurring. But I'll tell you, it's far more frightening than the insurrection of January 6th, in my mind.
I agree.
It's far more frightening. It really is. It's a playbook now for the right. And they're going to engage this in every way they can to basically shut down this democracy, whatever's left of it. So I would say these are very dangerous times, and the convoy is symptomatic of that.
Thank you, Henry, for that. Sadly, I agree with you.
We've come to the end of our allotted time, Henry. I wanted to ask you if you could tell our audience how people can follow your work. It's Henry Giroux, G-I-R-O-U-X. Henry, how can people follow your work?
I have a website where I put all my work, and it's www.henryagiroux.com.
We hope you'll come back. We truly appreciated what you've had to teach us today. Thank you, Henry Giroux. You take it easy.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for the great questions.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.